This is Wendy Halley, and you're listening to Lucid Cafe. Welcome back. I hope that wherever you are, you're doing well. I know everyone here in Vermont seems to be pretty excited about spring. The leaves are starting to open. It's getting warmer. Going through a Vermont winter during a pandemic, not a lot of fun. Folks are practically skipping down the street. All right, maybe not skipping. Walking buoyantly. Speaking of buoyancy, no, that's not going to work. I can't think of a way to transition from buoyancy to near-death experiences. On second thought, maybe I just did. Today, I speak with Jacob Cooper about his new book, Life After Breath, How a Brush with Fatality Gave Me a Glimpse of Immortality, which captures how he came to terms with the near-death experience he had when he was 3 years old. Jacob is a licensed clinical social worker, a certified Reiki master, and a certified hypnotherapist, specializing in past life regression therapy. As a psychotherapist, Jacob works with individuals, groups, and families in managing emotional barriers, promoting improved wellness and resiliency. Jacob incorporates mindfulness and a spiritual approach to focus on the connection between the mind, body, and spirit. Please enjoy my conversation with Jacob Cooper. Jacob, thanks so much for coming on the show.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me on as your honored guest here.
Absolutely. And congratulations on your new book.
Thank you. Thank you. Life After Breath is out on Amazon, and it's a powerful, inspirational memoir, my near-death experience. And I feel very blessed and humbled to have a book out there for people to read.
Yeah, so let's dive in and talk about this book a little bit, or a lot of bit, actually. The official title is Life After Breath, How a Brush with Fatality Gave Me a Glimpse of Immortality. It's quite a title.
Yes, yes. The title, I was chewing over a couple different ones, but I sat in prayer and meditation and just kind of asked what's kind of like a good title that will kind of summarize my near-death experience that I speak about in my book, or, you know, encompasses a lot more than just that. And this title came about because, you know, I think right now, working as a psychotherapist in the field of mental health, I think the common theme is that people feel just very much out of breath, out of energy. They just feel very fatigued. And so my goal is really for this book to give people a fresh new insight and new breath as we enter into the new year during everything that we've been through this past year.
A breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
The title does really capture the experience you write about in your book. So if you don't mind, can you share the highlights of your near-death experience? Because I think that would be really helpful for people to hear what that was like for you, and then we can go into what impact that had on your life.
Sure. I was 3 years old at the time. I had an upper respiratory, highly contagious virus called pertussis, otherwise, you know, generically known as whooping cough. And so I went with family friends to a park that day, just kind of expected to have a fun day, but something just in the back of my mind told me that something big was on the horizon that I couldn't quite label or touch. And so I went to the park and I went onto a slide, and I literally, as I was climbing up on the slide, my breathing became a lot more resuscitated and difficult and labored. And as I was on the last rung of the ladder going onto the slide, I literally, you know, suffocated and lost my breath. And that's when every part of my body, including my brain, just stopped working, wasn't functioning. And the last memory that I had was my brain, just a loud sound that just felt like a crack, that my brain cracked in half. And that's when, you know, the other side, or God, came in. And once my brain just cracked open, that's when I raced down this insane tunnel down to the infinite light. And I was aware or cognizant of angelic beings, spiritual guides, soul family members, and what I like to describe as God, and as well as Christ awareness or Christ consciousness that happened. It also gave me intel and information onto soul's purpose, previous carnations, and a little bit more awareness as to what this lifetime was about from understanding the greater orchestrated game plan with an intelligence far greater than my own. One of the most significant parts was many near-death experiencers will say that they had no choice, that they had to stay in the other side. And so for myself, I was given the option of staying or going, and I chose to stay based off of, what I was provided to and what I was being shown through my guides, angels, and spirit of, heaven is great, but incorporating the hereafter to the here now was, something that I was trying to do within this body in this lifetime. And ultimately, that's, I think, all of our goals is to bring who we are, where we come from, to this foreign place here on Earth.
Okay. So can I explore that experience a little bit
Absolutely.
More with you?
Please do. Yes.
Because you use a very strong word, crack. My brain cracked. Open or in half?
Right. I wasn't Humpty Dumpty or something like that, but literally that's a sound that I could kind of like express where due to the deprivation of oxygen, I just heard like a large, like an insane just cracking sound where it literally just felt like it snapped in half. And there's a saying
in your head,
in my brain, my actual brain, due to the deprivation of oxygen. And, people have a saying that my brain cracked open and God came in. That happened to me where I felt my brain just shutting down, and almost you take like a power breaker in a home and just yank it out of the wall. And, it just isn't there. That's just kind of what happened to me. It just felt like it just snapped.
Like you went offline.
Yeah. Yeah. I was
in the physical reality.
Yeah, we plugged out of the physical and plugged into the, other side.
All right. And so you also said that you were privy to all of this knowledge through your experience. I'm imagining it at 3 years old to have this experience. And then I'm just thinking developmentally, when you're three, you don't have the capacity for abstract thought yet. So when you are resuscitated and I that's what I want to talk to you about a little bit is how did you as a three-year-old, did you even make sense of it? Or, you talk about this in your book that it actually was something that hit you in a deeper way as you got older, or there was an insight around, wow, that happened to me. Hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I would say, none of us are our bodies or our chronological ages. That's how we portray ourselves to the world. That's a very much just the surface of who we are. So this was happening to a much deeper part of myself that went far beyond the physical age or 3 years old. This happened to the eternal vantage point of my soul on a very deep level. And so within three-year-olds, there's an external portrayal of that age where the soul and the body familiarize themselves, and that takes time. But there's whole under interplay of this inner world that happens within anyone who comes to this planet. And so that's a deeper kind of waters of consciousness. And so when I was in this experience, I was really tapping into, not necessarily just the limited three-year-old body, but the eternal soul with eternal awareness. And so if it's possible for people to have memories of previous carnations, right, past lives, why is it not possible for people to also remember stuff that happened very early on in their lives and connect to a part that's much greater than themselves?
Right. Yeah, I don't conflict with that at all. It's just more you can have one of these really highly spiritual experiences and then trying to make sense of it in mm-hmm. your brain afterwards when you're a little kid, I imagine you just sort of take it for, all right, this happened to me. Maybe that's normal. Maybe that happens to everybody.
Right, right. It took, and near-death experience researchers support, what happened to me in my life, where they'll say that it takes around 20 to 30 years for an infant to integrate and process their experience. And so for myself, the turn of events, whatever happened, but to be able to ground it, not on the not take ownership of it from a spiritual perspective, but be able to ground this in this body, in this lifetime, in this earth, and be able to communicate it and process it, you know, that took a couple of decades.
Yeah, that's more of what I was talking about. Yeah. For you to be able to talk about this now is one thing, but if we had asked you, if 3-year-old Jacob was sitting here right now chatting with me, and I was asking him about this experience, I can't imagine how he would try to relay it other than in a very matter-of-fact sort of, I had this experience. This is who I talked to. This is what happened.
Yeah, you know, I think most near-death experiencers shut down because whatever they experienced was so profound, and words are just so limited in terms of their expression, in terms of their ability to just encompass and describe what occurred. And so as I got older, the event stayed the same, but the ability to articulate it to other people increased. And so I was able to, you know, express it. And still, words I view as quite limiting. They don't encompass the love, the eternal love on the other side and what transpired. But it's the ultimate superpower that I have to give over to other people. Because ultimately, if I just hold on to this experience, it has no value other than to myself. I fully believe that any experience isn't just for yourself, but rather to create a ripple effect from its impact on other people.
Right. So hence you're writing this book, right? That was your wish, I imagine, and what you said earlier.
Yeah. You know, I hope I did my best to plant my seed and, you know, try to really relay it to other people as best as I could. But, you know, my goal is for people not to get too attached to my story, but to have this story allow other people to take ownership of their own stories, and for something to be familiar within my story of their own memories that go far beyond this body and this lifetime.
One of the things I'm really fascinated with is how we make sense of these kinds of experiences. Like, I think back to when I had my first visionary experiences, and I just kind of tucked them away because I didn't quite know what to do with them. I didn't know how to make sense of them. And I'm also, as a clinician as well, I'm also really aware of how powerful our beliefs are in acting as a filter for how we interpret these things. Do you see that as something that you wrestled with? Did you have an existing kind of spiritual foundation, and then you have this experience? Did it fit with it, or did it conflict, or how did you make sense of this as a human being with your spirituality?
You know, the life that I grew up in and the culture, you know, religious background was very much diametrically opposite, you know, and not congruent with what I experienced on the other side. It was very different. It's kind of ironic that within my experience, it happened at the time of Yom Kippur in September of 1993, which is the Holy of Holy Days in the Jewish tradition, a time where you really kind of tend to cleanse yourself before you meet the Creator. It's try to have a year of health and well-being, prosperity for the new year. And so it's a time of atonement, a time of judgment. And so from that time, in 1993, I had quite a different experience with the Creator. It wasn't, you know, God in man's image. It was a God or universe much different than anything that we know of in this lifetime. And that was just unconditional love, understanding, and words that just couldn't describe it. The God that's almost described in many religions is very much a God of this earth. It's not a God that is above it that we can't comprehend within our own experiences. And so the rituals, the laws, the parts that you had to strive to become something to get something, the transactional dynamic and checklist was a lot different than the God that I experienced that, you know, loved you for who you've always been and who you always were, as you are a part of the eternal God force. So,
yeah, that makes sense to me. Again, based on my own experiences, I'm thinking that kind of love you encounter, it's not like human love, right? It's or lust.
Right.
It's devoid of humanness.
Yeah, many different form of Greek loves, right? You know, the agape love and all that other stuff. But you know, when you think of the eternity, I mean, the closest word that comes to mind is love. And so eternal love, with, for us to process eternity itself. Our left brain can't do it because that's linear. It's limited within this body. And so that's one of the things that I really took on from my experience is not only the eternity of time where there was no time, but the eternity of everything. There was no limitation of anything. There was no roof or anything stopping it. And so, but love was truly the real theme of what I experienced, and a love far beyond whatever I experienced up until 3 years old in this lifetime, which isn't a knock to my environment or family, you know.
No, it's just different.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just different. Yeah. The only way I can describe that place that you went to is that there's nothing human about it. Did you have that experience, or did you feel it as being a very human experience, a human-esque experience?
I would say the only human-esque part was the actual placement of the other side. I think in a way I speak about this in my book, the other side, you know, I was going infinitely up where there was no stopping it, but the other side is also, I experienced right in front of us, right? And so when my body was just on the ground, irresponsive to calls, I experienced tons of angels in front of me. So the other side is just a dimension or a dial slightly above an overlaying filter of this world. But the features of it, the energy, just the unconditional love of it is very, very much different. You know, as well as just transparency of thought, where you can't be a politician there or just kind of, you know, just kind of like fake your way in, whatever you think is echoed. So it's very much transparent. What I would say, though, is I did have my own thoughts, like whatever happened outside of me transformed. But I still had my worries. I still had my thoughts. I still had an incubation period of adjustment when I was crossing over. And so I guess the human part is that you take yourself with you, but you become a lot more aware of who you are, what you're connected to. But the inner dialogue was still there. You know.
So it's a lot more expansive. But you're more than you.
Yeah. And I view who we are as almost kind of when you close your eyes and get into meditation, it's that sacred eternal observer that's always there, you know, and that just energy that you have that can't be destroyed. And when people meditate, I view that as a great rapport with your eternal self and the eternity itself. And the more you're able to meditate, the more you're able to tap into that peace. You know, some will call it the soul, the observer, you know, in Buddhist meditation traditions. But it's just imagining that part, that quantum field that's no longer there. And so you take that deep water essence of yourself, but that becomes a lot more aware of its surrounding, and it's in a way you become immensely a lot more uplifted, but you still have, you know, those thoughts. And I would love to get into those thoughts because I think it's important for people to understand on many levels as to what I was thinking, because that's a wonderful question. Were you three? Were you this eternal soul? And I would say that
I was both, yeah.
In a way, yes, that I carried both. In a sense that my awareness was a lot more than just this body and other lifetimes, but also I had attachment to the three-year-old life that I was living, and I worried about, and not to sound too self-aggrandizing, but what my parents would think if I would have passed away. That stuck with me, and I just remember just the irony of just forgetting who I truly was, where I just was programmed to just see myself as this limited three-year-old self. And when I touched into that, I just saw myself in so many different lifetimes and bodies that I had no attachment to that age in a way. And so it just, you know, threw me off from how I was being programmed as I got from the shores of the other side to identify myself with this body, this lifetime, this age, and this number. And I was tapped into a much greater awareness that I was not all that. And I was kind of that at the same time too. It's kind of hard to explain.
No, I think I'm understanding what you're saying, at least as much as I'm capable of understanding someone else's experience in this very ethereal place. Right. So are you saying that you had glimpses of other incarnations that you had lived?
Yes. And I speak about this in Life After Breath. The most relevant incarnation, you know, that I had was actually evidentially proven through various different intuitives who haven't read my book, never read my story. This was before I ever started getting public, which was around the 2016 time, 2015, 2016 time. And that was a lifetime in which I took my own life and I committed suicide. And within my near-death experience, I actually saw the faces of the different students that I taught within that lifetime. And again, there is emotion when you cross over the other side that is a part of you. I was very emotional after seeing them, quite upset, and felt like, in a way, I just abandoned that lifetime and there was just unfinished business that I wanted to continue on. And so, in a way, this lifetime was very much a build-off from completion we begin. It was just kind of like a build-off of where that last lifetime kind of ended. And I speak about this a little bit more in my next book that I'm writing, which is more of the, you know, direct implicative lessons of that NDE in a toolbook and a guidebook from the hereafter to the here now. But in a sense, the allegorical reference of the light at the end of the tunnel, in a sense that when I was suffocated and I had absolutely no life to hold on to, there was eternity that I can never be separated from. And so I saw how it spoke to me personally and professionally, the life that I live right now, were to kind of enhance people's superpowers of resiliency when they're feeling very apathetic and they've lost, you know, any bit of energy to live, to understand what's around them, what's inside of them, is far greater than the challenges in front of themselves in different ways. And that was an impetus behind writing this book.
You mean the access to that particular lifetime?
The access to that particular lifetime, but in a sense how within that lifetime I gave a lot more power to impermanent fears, anxieties, worries, and I felt paralyzed by that. And instead of giving a lot more power over to faith, knowing, and the ability to ask for guidance around myself.
All right. So that's what I was wondering, because of the many lifetimes that you have likely lived, why did that one come to the foreground?
Right.
I mean, suicide, that's a tough topic, right?
Yeah.
And I certainly, in my shamanic practice, have my experiences around perceiving the essence of folks who have successfully suicided. And that it's kind of, I mean, I don't know if you had this experience or not when you had a glimpse into this lifetime, but that the very thing that the people who took their own lives were trying to get away from, they weren't able to get away from. And that was the pain that they were experiencing. So the emotions, the imprint of the emotions came with them. And then all of the healing that has to happen as a result of that experience. And then, of course, the impact, the ripple effect that has on the people who they've left behind. And did it seem similar to that, or was it totally different?
In a sense, my last lifetime was very much like I felt very much cornered and I had nowhere to go. And I just felt very much trapped, you know, within kind of like a fall of events. But what I would say is within my practice, within my own experience, it's oftentimes very much an isolated feeling when you feel very much alone within your own suffering and you just have no idea what to do about it and becomes so overwhelming that you just can't hold on to that pain and just don't know what to do with it. And so you just kind of internalize the heaviness of pain because it becomes too overwhelming. I would say that, but I would say that from my near-death experience is a lot different than what a lot of people interpret as suicide, where, you know, A, it's a decision that we, as obviously as clinicians, we try to prevent at all costs, you know, but in a sense, you don't go to another realm that condemns you or judges you or punishes you. You go actually to a place of, you know, immense compassion, empathy, understanding, love, and healing. But ultimately, you know, within each lifetime, I think we're in very much trying to not learn anything, but to integrate what we already know in the face of the absence of it at times. So I think it's about not necessarily in the knowing, but about the implementing. And that leads to evolution within each and every lifetime.
Right. So do you feel like being exposed to that particular lifetime, and you're saying it was your most recent one in a chronological sense?
My most recent one, and the one that really had the most parallels with this within this lifetime. Within my work of past life aggressive therapy, as a certified hypnotherapist, you know, there's a lot of lifetimes that people live, but oftentimes what comes to us is not what we want to hear, but what we need to hear. And what is most important and implicative within the life that we're living today in many ways. Sometimes not, but.
Did you feel like there was a parallel thread in the challenges that that previous identity experienced and you as Jacob have experienced?
Absolutely. And I have struggled with that at times, just in terms of different moments in my life, feeling my back against the wall.
Right.
What to do with it and about kind of ending. And I think in a way that's made me a stronger clinician, a more empathic clinician. It's helped me understand people. But more importantly, through those scenarios, through those same kind of different time frames, different cultures, different settings, but that same play at head, I'm able to be a little bit more skillful in how I go about it. And that's a part of evolving. So
absolutely, yeah.
You know, I think it's the chess pieces are kind of the same on the board, but I've learned, you know, different moves to make to handle the stimuli that I'm provided, you know, in life and challenges.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, especially based on, again, what I experienced with the folks who had suicided. Like you said, there was no judgment around it. There was no
condemnation, judgment.
No, they weren't condemned at all. It was more what I perceived, and this is probably going to sound batshit to some folks, but their council of elders, when they consulted with them about that decision that was made to end their lives, that they were strongly encouraged in their next lifetime to have a very similar series of circumstances to see if they could maybe find the strength to make a different decision, to be able to try to reach deep down inside of themselves and find that strength and try to push through and find some meaning and some purpose in their lives so that they feel like they can get out of that, I guess, that state of feeling emotionally cornered, like I have no other options.
Absolutely. And there's, like we said before, approach and attitude is everything. You know, perception is everything. And so a lot of people could feel very much within this lifetime that it's a punishment or that, you know, where we have to go back to and take the Regents or the SATs because we failed.
Right.
Dirty, vindictive kind of school. But I try to always take the high road on a personal, professional level, which is these are what we're seeing. How could we see this from a higher vantage point? How can we take a higher road of perception? So what one could view as a punishment, I see, you know, in a way as an opportunity. And what could see as a challenge, you know, other people could back away from it. Some could decide to really embrace that because growth and challenge go hand in hand. I've never met someone who's evolved and really ascended in their lifetimes without having the rug being pulled on them or a shakeup period and finding a new and better footing to stand on had that not happened before.
Usually more than once.
Usually more than once, and that's happening on a micro and macro basis in today's world.
Right. And are you saying from a human perspective that they may perceive coming back as punishment? Is that what you mean?
Well, I think some people could easily view that, right, in the face of challenges as to why, you know, am I in this hellhole given all these kind of things?
Right.
You know, what is this kind of abusive, punishing God that's putting me all these through with all these things? And, you know, I'd say that it's a unique opportunity to re-remember and reintegrate what we know in our hearts, and to give all of this negativity and taking the power on our inner level and putting negativity and all these challenges to the powerless form that it came from. Because ultimately, darkness is not there unless if we're able to see the light behind it and see its illusion.
You need both.
Right, you need both. The darkness illuminates the light, right? But at the end of the day, that light casts a big shadow, and that's what I try to gravitate to. But the yin and yang work well and together.
So how would you translate that in your everyday life? Because that's a very very esoteric kind of concept. So how would you say to someone who may not understand what that means?
Right. I view, you know, mindfulness as a wonderful practice that's really becoming a lot more mainstream, that has spirituality with practicality implications, in a sense that you're able to integrate all these things within day-to-day experiencing. And so within mindfulness, a key principle is a stimuli response dynamic, right? We get, you know, like a bad thing that we could say that happened to us that causes us to feel as if we're trapped. And so that's kind of what's happened to us. But our ability to respond to it, you know, is our ultimate superpower and freedom. So we walked into that. And so how do we find freedom in the face of our hands being tied in a difficult situation? And so our approaches, our engagement between the stimuli and response will thus influence our experiences. And so it's not so much what happened to us, but rather what's happening on an inner level that could cause us to really engage with almost anything and create, you know, freedom in the face of adversity or imprisonment within difficult situations. And I think ultimately it's tapping into something inside of us in the face of something outside of us that will determine that.
Right. I think when we are focused externally, and I think most of us, that's where we live, is right, kind of focused on the external world and trying to manipulate and control the things around us to make us feel okay inside, when the truth is, like you're saying, it seems that where the power really lies is internally, where you have actual control.
Sure. About 2 weeks ago, we had Holocaust Remembrance Day, right? And throughout the last 100, 200 years, we think of the most difficult, imprisoned, you know, time frame and era, you know, in dark periods. That had to be it in terms of human suffering and the level of it. But Viktor E. Frankl, who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, you know, is really someone who a lot of people speak about within mindfulness in terms of finding ultimate freedom in the face of imprisonment. And if you read Man's Search for Meaning, I think ultimately all those challenges and struggles don't just happen in those moments. They're there for a reason, and we're to integrate and carry, you know, those much more difficult situations into our own everyday lives. And so, you know, Viktor could have easily said, I'm just in the barracks of concentration camps. I have every freedom taken away from me. I've got nothing. And so I'm dead. I'm a leaf in water. I'm just, there's my life. But, you know, he decided to really understand that it wasn't on the outside that determined his lifetime, but it was an inner place within. And as Michelangelo would say, the masterpiece that we chip away each and every day, you know, that true part of ourselves that is always there. And so within my near-death experience, that's one of the kind of key takeaways that I have of it within my life or my talks, is to understand what we give our power to over. The second we identify ourselves with the part far greater than our body, we start to be able to perceive events a lot differently and how events come to pass. And so I can understand how people struggle if they see themselves as the body. The body is very infinite, or just see themselves as...
or finite, yeah.
You know, right. Kind of limited, isolated agents. But if you see yourself as infinite, with infinite force behind you, around you, with the ability that can never be hurt nor damaged nor harmed, you're able to really persevere in the face of challenges and embrace that a lot more from understanding, not necessarily believing that, but having an inner knowing of that. So that's something that I really try to take with me.
I was thinking about Viktor Frankl as you were talking before. And I think another important piece too that he brought forward from his horrendous experience was the importance of finding meaning for yourself, to be able to put things into perspective, and the idea that, yeah, like you're saying, this, that perception is everything, that how you perceive is going to color your interpretation of your experience. And that's something you can change, is how you're perceiving, what you believe about something. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do, but you can certainly, we're not prisoners to our beliefs.
What we were born with, what we will take with us, ultimately what we're defined by. What we can't take with us is things that we can't be defined by, you know, which is our homes, our cars, and all these things are vehicles and tools to allow us to live, sure. But, you know, I think ultimately there's an impermanence of life with the body. There's an impermanence within the life that we know. Everything is constantly in flux. And so how do we engage with that impermanence? You know, we could look at the body and understanding, and I think right now for a lot of people with everything happening, you know, that's been very much sped up, that the body is not here forever, that any moment anything can change. We could look at that within a lot of fear, or we can embrace each and every moment that we have that is not promised within this body. And so I think that's an important piece that hopefully people could take. And certainly at the age of 3 years old, I experienced that just like that, very simply. It could all just be taken at an innocent day in a park. And so, you know, I think a lot of people try to push things a couple of years down the road, or leave stuff in the tank, and I firmly believe that we're not here to leave anything in the tank. We're here to leave it all in the field if we can.
Well said. I like the native perspective that this world, this physical world, is the dream, and the dream time, the spirit world, where you went when you had your near-death experience, that that's the real world.
Yeah. No, I love this saying, to be in this world, but not of this world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So very much connected to another place. I think the struggle that people have is just the forgetfulness of who they are and where they come from. And that's the number one question that people have, is their life's purpose. And, you know, so many people's purpose is defined with based off of perception, how we see ourselves, how we see the world, and our worldview, implicates everything. And I think if we're able to understand that there's a far greater intelligence that created us, that had this path in the between lives, I think we're able to really entrust in staying on the field and staying course and being able to connect ourselves intuitively to a far greater awareness than our own within our lifetimes, to guide us through grace and ease as much as we can through this lifetime.
Have you ever read Michael Newton's books?
I've seen, you know, he's an author that nearly everyone speaks about, particularly regarding In Between Lives.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly have seen them. I love the cover. There's something that I'm definitely going to try to look into. Definitely on my reading list.
It's the book I recommend the most.
Yeah.
Journey of Souls, his first book. It captures my experiences in that place more than anything else I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
It's really very cool. And I think it's a great perspective for those of us who don't have a near-death experience to lean on or to borrow from. It gives this perspective. It kind of opens your mind up to these other possibilities. And it also kind of helps to make sense of some things too. Yeah, it's just a really cool perspective, a broader, more cosmological perspective.
Yeah. Very cosmological. I mean, the cover I know has stars and everything in a picture. There's, I mean, that's a book that everyone, I've never met someone who hasn't raved about that book.
Yeah.
It really goes over well with everyone. So,
well, add me to the list. So let me switch gears a little bit. I'm curious about how you would handle skeptics. A three-year-old has an experience like you mm-hmm. did, and it's clearly a life-altering experience. How do you handle folks who say that, that was really the byproduct of your brain shutting down, a lack of oxygen to the brain, but, you know, you still likely had brain activity, that maybe what you were perceiving were hallucinations, albeit probably very linear hallucinations that made more sense than physical reality made. But yeah, how would you handle that?
That inner skeptic, you know, and the skeptical energy really caused me to hold this in for over 20 years. I come from a family that more so embraces the here now than the hereafter. And so I speak about this in my book. I knew that my mother had no idea where I was, and I wasn't even able to explain what I had for a number of years. And I tried to bury the beach ball under the water for a long time. And I tried to run from it. I tried to just be a regular person. That would have been much, whatever that means, but that would have been much easier. But there just came a point where this experience was following me wherever I went. And there was a certain point where it had to come out. And from telling it, you know, I was very scared, sure, but it was quite cathartic. But I, within history, when you have a message, no matter who you are, that's subject to backlash, criticism, ridicule, you know, from people. And that's just a part of the territory. But so much of that is really a test of faith. It's a test of, do I really trust in this, right? Or do I trust in, you know, the criticism and the negativity of this? And when you get in your own head, that could drive you crazy. But I had to say to myself, I trust in God. I trust this in experience far more so, you know, than the criticism in front of me. But I would say skepticism is quite healthy, whether you're going through a mediumship reading, intuitive reading, or hearing a near-death experiencer. I think that's very important. I think there's a big difference between cynicism and skepticism. So I really encourage people to be skeptical, and I encourage them to not believe in me. I don't want people to believe in me. I want you to believe in yourself. Because if you believe in me, that becomes almost kind of like a cult kind of thing and a very much attachment thing. And that becomes borderline religion. And I want people to take ownership of the truth that never left them in their own backyard versus someone outside of themselves. But I have skepticism about my own near-death experience. If you even listen to an interview that I did, let's say a couple years ago, I'll say that I was 5 years old in that interview. I couldn't wrap my head around that I was 3 years old, at least publicly. It just didn't make sense to me that it was that long ago and I was able to articulate and remember it. It wasn't until maybe 2-3 years ago where I sat down with my mother. We had a conversation. She goes, "You weren't 4 or 5 years old. You were 3 years old." And that really blew my head away because it felt like a second ago. And again, it relates to trauma. You know, suffocation is intensified trauma, as well as the intensified euphoria, not of this body, not of this earth, that happened. And so that's really could make sense why I don't remember very little other than the surrounding events of this experience, you know, happening at age 3 years old. But it's inspired me to destigmatize how infants are treated and perceived as just this blank slate. And that's inspired the road that I had, you know, within past life regression therapy and working with different parents to be able to really look at their children and infants, not as just a piece of meat, a body, a blank slate, but rather this whole eternal soul that's far beyond the surface of what is perceived, if that makes sense.
Yeah, kids that little perceive so much. They're way open. One of my favorite things is to read about or hear about kids who have who have their past life memories, and they'll start rattling off details of lives that they've lived. Man, I think that's just so compelling.
Oh.
And then around 6 years old, when developmentally we start developing our sense of self and that left brain starts to come online in a bigger way, all that perception starts to shrink.
Right. In many ways. And I think it has to do with the power and control dynamic. We're in a sense that we're taught from a very young age that we don't have the power, that we have to, you know, gain knowledge, gain all these things to become something, that we don't already have it. And so there's this kind of relationship with the teacher, with the parent, and like a pedestal of something outside of ourselves that is telling us all these things. And there's that dynamic that takes place. And so early on in life, it's at least in the Western world, it's very much information process is valued and being able to regurgitate and all that kind of stuff. And so the left brain becomes a lot more used versus the own inner muscle being tapped into and the sacred silence being really placed into value. And so it's more of the left brain processing than the inner processing.
Right. Not a lot of room for balance between both experiences.
It's changing. I mean, the world right now is much different. I mean,
Yeah, because we're pretty fucked up. Something has to change. I mean, I often wonder if the Western world hadn't developed in precisely the way it did, where we'd be as a race if we didn't get into this very externally focused left brain dominant. So I always refer to it as top heavy, like really in our thinking minds more than in our perceptive minds or in our bodies or however you want to put it. I wonder what the world would look like if we didn't go down that road, but here we are.
Right.
And so now we're trying to unravel, I guess, and put the brakes on or whatever we're trying to do.
I mean, there are slow steps. I mean, you look at classrooms right now, they're integrating mindfulness within classrooms, you know, in terms of the information. I mean, it's more, you know, regurgitation still and just trying to pass tests and all that kind of stuff and one ear out the other. But, you know, at least there's a part of the school system that values a person's mental health, that values the inner game, that understands the quiet as a correlationship between being able to be as productive as possible. There's studies, you can't find one successful person, it's hard to find, who doesn't actually practice meditation. You look at any successful entrepreneur, most of them, a large percentage of them practice meditation. And it's very hard to be our best self without that. But, you know, even on, let's say, Netflix, there's new documentary Surviving Death just came out, which has really been booming. there's a segment of that of children's past life memories. And so,
yeah, I saw that. It's really cool.
Mainstream awareness of children is starting to be a little bit challenged from these undeniable different case studies and examples of children, matter-of-factly, undeniably remembering their past lives evidentially. So
we went many directions, I'd say. We covered a lot of ground.
Yes, that's that's always good. And like I said before, with viewers, the last thing I want any interview to be is to be pigeonholed. I want it to have something for everyone in there, you know, and just some type of insight for everyone to hold on to. So that's what I try to go for, at least when I interview.
Is there anything you wish we would have talked about that we didn't?
I think in general, you know, maybe the larger macro perspective on transformative experiences, you know, what's happening today. I think in a way you look at what's happening today. Back in 1975, when Raymond Moody came out with Life After Life and coined the term NDE, you know, that was such a new ground, a new area. Near-death experience has been around for thousands of years, you know, documented through religion and different Greek philosophers and all this kind of stuff. But it's caught a lot more credibility, mainstream awareness, as people like Dr. Eben Alexander has come out, Raymond Moody has come out with it, Dr. Mary Neal, who is on Surviving Death. You know, so the more credible, you know, I guess people come out with these experiences, give confidence and give more acknowledgement to it. But I think what's happening is near-death experiences are really exploding today, you know, for many reasons. I think the incubation period between life and death is extending as medical modalities are improving and people are able to really form a tangible understanding of it. And so I think for people who are listening, who maybe, let's just say, having a near-death experience and understanding that there's so many different forms of transformative experiences that you could take ownership of. And I speak about this in my book. I had this experience, but the most helpful and grounding measure was to be able to read someone's story. Her name was Betty Ady, who wrote the book Embraced by the Light, who also had that. Once I had a label over it, I gave more universality and confidence to go publicly with it, because otherwise there's just this big thing that I had no idea to know about. And so I think with other people, I think the greatest asset that people could have is to gain support, to have communities, and to take ownership of whatever you have. Because ultimately what I had, I thought it was pretty cool, but I didn't think much of it. And so it's not so much of what we think. We could all chop ourselves until we're nothing, right? But I think ultimately there's a great importance of taking ownership of your story and creating that ripple effect. Because I think in a way, I view the universe as one big musical verse. And if we're able to portray our own sound, our own octave within each and every lifetime better and not just hold on to it and not express it, we're contributing to the divine collective symphony of this human game, human race that we're playing. So I think it's very important for people to find different resources and different avenues to express their own inspired stories in their own ways.
That was very poetic.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I love the idea of always encouraging people to try to find a way to have their own experiences. I'm not talking about dying to have those kinds of experiences.
Yeah.
But whether it's some kind of practice that brings your focus inward. I'm a big fan of psychedelic assisted therapies that are helping folks access these other perspectives with guidance in a very safe way. And people are not the same after they have these experiences, similar to a near-death experience. I think one of the things I found that's so fascinating is the statistically significant way in which people who've had NDEs are changed afterwards. Things like they tend to become spiritual, but not religious. They are more interested in the environment. They're less materialistic.
The purpose-driven element and the desire to help out others. A lot of people ask me what I think of myself, and I'd say I don't see myself as anything different than anyone else, other than, you know, I had a shakeup of consciousness. And so my job isn't to tell anyone anything that they don't know, but rather to just gently remind people and tap people on the shoulder to wake up if they are asleep at the wheel and they're not really living authentically and tuned into a greater awareness that they might not be privy to. And so my job is just to gently do that. It's not to tell anything that people don't in their deep of hearts, I believe, know. But I think the only other piece I would say is within my book, the reason why I got very personal was not self-congratulatory or anything like that. It was for two reasons. A, you, from a social worker's perspective, there's a psychosociological developmental perspective that's very important to highlight within this experience. Because in a way, having this experience is pretty cool, but how you're able to live with it and integrate it is important to not only express, but to have people to take ownership of. Because I do believe the universality element of this near-death experience speaks to us all. We come from this place of eternity, we get programmed, but for people are tuning into, there's something that is a part of ourselves that doesn't necessarily add up to all that we perceive ourselves as. And we feel quite deprived, depressed, because in a way, we're nurturing the physical, we're nurturing the body, but we're not tuning into and listening to the sacred voice within. And so I think in a way, for people who haven't had near-death experiences, the most important part is you don't have to go through the trauma that I went through to re-experience that through different practices and different techniques you could do that. But I think in a way, it's something that's inside of us all, and it can never leave us, or we can never truly leave it. So it's always there.
All right. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your program. Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about Jacob and his new book, Life After Breath, please visit his website, jacoblcooper.com. I've included a link in the show notes. A million thanks for listening. I hope you'll consider supporting the podcast by helping me spread the word, or subscribing so that you never miss an episode, or giving Lucid Cafe a positive review on whatever platform you use. You can also support the podcast by making a one-time or monthly donation of any amount using the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. Until next time.